I'm Andy Bush. I'm here to tell you about our weekly board games podcast that you might just love called Bush's Board Game Thing. Every week, me, Brian and Eloise get together, sit around a table, play a few board games and mainly just go off on massive tangents about life and stuff like that. It's less about the minutiae of the board games themselves. What we love is the fact that games bring people together and can spark conversation. Each week, we have a terrible board game fact from Brian, which absolutely makes him ramble into the wall. And one of you guys get in touch to pitch us a board game that hasn't been made yet. Our favourite so far was an extremely tired dad who came up with a board game about camping and going for a wee in a hedge. Bush's Board Game Thing, give it a listen. It might just change your life.
Hi, I'm Mel Frizzell and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm sitting under a hawthorn bush that smells so strongly of old knickers. I feel a bit like I'm back in year 10 PE. It's quite a heady time for flowers, actually. It's like the whole of the natural world is trying to get laid at the moment, and good on them, I say. My guest on the podcast this week is the children's author, illustrator and poet, Laura Dockrill. I've followed Laura and her fuchsia lipstick for years. She's part of this whole wave of creative people, singers, DJs, writers, that just seem to bring so much joy to what they did, and I really like seeing what they're producing. But after reading her book called What Have I Done, which details her experience of being admitted to a psychiatric ward after suffering from postpartum psychosis, I just knew we had to have her on the podcast. The humour, the detail, the honesty in the book is amazing. And in person, she was just as amazing. And as I've always said, the panic years don't end neatly with a partner, a house or a job. So it was really nice to get this glimpse into what I'm calling the aftermath. After my chat with Laura, I then interviewed Dr. Benjamin Janaway, who works as an NHS psychiatrist. I wanted to talk to him about how people get admitted to psychiatric care, what that might look like, and how eventually people can get better. So hopefully, from this episode, you can hear from both a patient and a doctor with experience of psychiatric care. Obviously, I want you to approach that with caution, and some of what we might talk about might not be suitable for everyone. But hopefully, if you do choose to listen, you'll find it as enlightening as I did. I just want to warn you before we start that during our conversation, Laura and I do discuss suicidal thoughts and suicidal ideation. How are you and how is your body?
I'm really good. I had my jab on Saturday, so I'm feeling like that. I mean, we had our jab at the Science Museum, which made me feel
super
futuristic and scary. But also Hugo was like, it's weird that it's next to the History Museum because we were very close to being extinct. And then it started me on this, this brain pattern thinking, what if in the future they don't even need dinosaurs in the History Museum and they'll need humans in the History Museum because we'll just be androids walking around that were like, ooh, this is how humans once were because of COVID. So my brain was going down that path.
You made it dark. Well done.
I've got a real habit of that, as you might have noticed. My arm feels like really, as you said, Popeye when we first said hello today, which is exactly right. I was looking for the diagnosis, but it was Popeye was what I was looking for.
Yeah, that's it.
My body, so yeah, that's kind of myself and my body. So I guess mixed emotions, but very relieved, I think. So good, yeah, good, very good.
Although I'd read your book before, I wanted to give it a reread. And my God, what have I done? It's just, I mean, from the title onwards, it's such a beautiful, heartbreaking, but for someone like me, righteous book. I wanted to stand up and be like, yes, 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 yes. This is what it's like. And read you a bit of your book. Like,
oh, please. Like I'll probably cringe, but please.
Great. Great. Get ready to cringe out your spine. I've made a demanding, screaming alien and I don't know how I did it. My body doesn't feel like mine anymore. Why did I even have a baby in the first place? How can I even be thinking that? Maybe the baby's ruined everything. Maybe the baby's robbed me of my life. I've made a mistake. Oh God, having these thoughts makes me a bad mum. Great, I'm a bad mum. I've not even started. Give me a chance. No, actually, I don't want a chance. I'm a failure. I can't even put my finger on why, but I'm so scared. I don't want to be a mum. I can't do it. I could have written that. I can't believe that you've put it down on the page for me. It's so familiar and it's so powerful. And it's such a relief to hear it, which is like
I'm crying so
fast. But in like that feeling of being simultaneously trying to be a mum and judging yourself for being a mum. Trying to be a woman, judging yourself for being a woman, trying to be alive, judging yourself for being alive. How did you know that you were ready to write that? How did you put it on the page?
So much you were saying there that I was like, I think I felt relief. Just how weird that I have gone through this and it's all I talk about all day long. But even when you hear somebody that, you know, you admire and think, oh, she's a pretty normal person, healthy person going, yeah, I can relate to that. I still have that inner person, in the little voice in me going, you made this all up. You're just messed up in the head. You're just you're thinking everyone else feeling this, but you're just pretending sort of thing. So anytime that, you know, someone like you says, I can relate to that, I just feel so much relief. Like I think, oh, okay, it wasn't just me, you know that. And it just... if that my unwell person itself could hear that, I would think that would be enough to get me through another day.
I remember looking down into my child's face and thinking, and he was like a couple of days old, and thinking, I could probably leave you in a wood if I had to like run away. I could probably put you at the bottom of a tree and run away because I don't feel like you're really here. You haven't really arrived. Mm. A howling twist of need that I am suddenly incredibly responsible for.
Totally hear that.
But your experience is different to mine because you couldn't sleep. I managed to go to sleep. Do you think that was what happened? Was like that the difference?
I really like that. I never have thought of that. And I like the simplicity of it because after I got unwell, I actually gave myself insomnia again, purely because I was... have you had a psychotic episode?
No.
Okay. I like the way you had to think about that. well, after a psychotic episode, I think it's quite normal, or anything strange, I suppose, but to go, what was that and why did that happen? I mean, I was looking back over every time in my life thinking, you did put your hamster vanilla in a drawer for a bit. Like, that was maybe mean. And you weren't that good at looking after plants. And if you think about it, you weren't always the most reliable friend. Things like that. Like, you look over, you... absolutely claw through every part of your past looking for reasons of why it happened and did it all lead to this. The sleep's a funny thing because there is so much pressure around sleep when you've had a baby. It's all people talk about. The baby needs to sleep, but you need to sleep. But it's all about the baby sleeping, but it's all about you sleeping. People give perfectly nice, well-intentioned people say, sleep when the baby sleeps. Get, you know, hand the baby over and go to sleep.
I could have stuck a fork in their face every time someone told me to sleep when the baby was asleep.
Totally. I really started to feel like a sort of fairy tale princess that had to slumber, you know, that the whole village was waiting outside my house. Did she manage it? You know, that sort of thing. And the pressure of that. And my house at this point was like Glastonbury Festival. So all my family were there waiting with bated breath. Did she sleep? And it became not about jet sleeping. As anyone who had a newborn, like, they're kind of pretty dry. Like, they're not going to karate classes on a Saturday morning. Like, they're just eating or sleeping or pooing, whatever. So it was not about the fear of him. It was all about me. I remember people trying to give me advice to sleep at this point. Now, this is really interesting because when I've spoken to doctors about this since, but I didn't get unwell because I didn't sleep. A symptom of my illness is sleeplessness and insomnia. But because I couldn't sleep, the illness gets worse. So it's like kind of a perpetuating cycle that one feeds the other. Of course, when you're in the throes of the illness and I've no history of mental illness, I didn't understand that. So I was taking as much sleep medication as I possibly could. But these tablets weren't even touching the sides. I've never done a drug in my life. You know, I fall asleep anywhere and I don't even like taking a paracetamol. So I would class myself a pretty much medication virgin. And I was bionic. I was like Sonic the Hedgehog. Like, this is something that could not take me down, you know. So the sleep thing is really interesting. Yes. And I mean, even on my doctor's notes, they said as well, children's author, very overactive imagination or something like that. And I was like, no, I didn't imagine myself into illness. Don't you think I would have wanted that my whole entire life when I was trying to write my angsty poetry when I was 15?
I've written and illustrated myself psychotic.
like Beatrice
if that
Potter.
Was a risk. Yeah, if that was a risk, we wouldn't really let people write children's books
anymore.
Yeah, I think
you put that pen down. You know what happened last time.
Let me back up because I feel like I'm so familiar with you. I've jumped in, but actually I should do the service to you, which is to say, can you tell us what happened?
So my son Jet, he's just over three now. After his birth, I had a very traumatic and chaotic labour. I began to get unwell. I've never had a history of mental illness, so I didn't recognise these early symptoms of anxiety, sleep deprivation, racing thoughts. I didn't. How was I supposed to know how to feel after I had kind of been awake for many hours? I mean, 2 days worth of hours, had nobody to kind of tell me what was going on, had been desperate to sort of have that cheerleader friend going, this is what you're doing to pump me up and say it's going to be okay. Then had been told that he had been starving inside my womb, my placenta had failed, and even though I was 2 weeks overdue, that he came out kind of skeletal, so his skin was really stretchy and long where he'd gained weight and then had lost it, starving, like screaming at me, angry. Then we're in this ward. So I didn't go, oh, this is not how, you know, my partner Hugo was like, you didn't seem you, but how are you? I didn't really know how you were going to feel. And then you'd been cut open and he'd been dragged out of you. And that's a lot, you know. So then we came home and I sort of thought that once I got home, everything would settle and I would feel better. But home sort of felt like, you know, when you go to like a holiday house or you've been away for a while and you come back to your home and it feels really ghostly and cold and everything just feels untouched. There's no dust. You're not like seeing dust, but you're like, oh, I've opened up a stale packed lunchbox. And I got into the bed thinking, okay, Hugo's like, let's just all get into the bed and it'll be okay. And I lay there. Of course, Hugo miraculously just fell asleep. Okay, just sleeping, like nothing's happened. Oh, and Jet's sleeping. And I was like, oh, no, this doesn't feel okay. And I said to him, I don't feel all right. And he was like, yeah, but we've just been through, you know, trauma. So he kept reminding me of that, which was really helpful. You know, you're not, how would you expect to feel? But within hours, that kind of feeling of anxiety, it really boiled down to dread. I felt dread in my teens briefly before. I think the first time was when I went to the cinema and I came out at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was like, you know, it was like, what is this life? Why is it the middle of the day? Why does it feel like the end of the world? And I couldn't put my finger on it. I got that, but like times a million, like it's been the summer holidays and you're back to school fear, but just like something bad's going to happen. Then it was like every ambulance, every police car going past sirening. I was like, they're coming for me. You've done something wrong. Didn't know what this was. Yeah.
You describe that brilliantly in the book. There's that bit about the kind of the adrenaline and cortisol means that everything feels like a wolf at the door. Like someone putting a teaspoon down on the side feels like the breaking of a window. Everything feels sinister.
No, you just put that better down.
No,
why
I didn't.
Didn't
no, I
didn't.
I think I was just misquoting your book.
I did not say that, but I'm like, that's so beautiful. I didn't say that. Thank you. That's very generous of you. You said by Laura Dockrell.
You knew something was up. You knew that, or, you know, rationally, you knew that you weren't right. And emotionally, you felt threatened. How did it turn into something where you were seeking help from a doctor and then going into hospital?
So it began with sleep. Because as I said, I'm always a good sleeper. And I was thinking, this is getting silly now. I'm actually lying. I'm like pretending to people that Jet's keeping me awake. So I'm going, oh yeah, like wanting to be like everyone else. Baby's a nightmare. The baby's sleeping. I'm like, no, be honest with yourself. The baby's fast asleep and you are climbing the walls. What is going on? I've never experienced sleeplessness before. So I dealt with sleeplessness in the worst way possible, you know, made myself feel like it was my own fault. You know, why can't you sleep like everybody else? You should be tired. You've just been through trauma. On top of that, you've lost blood. They all fed into each other, because I'd be like, your body needs to repair and recover the most. And the most when you need to repair and recover, you're not sleeping. Like, what? So that all for some reason, when you experience proper sleep deprivation, you feel so unsafe. You feel extremely vulnerable. Like, you feel like one of your basic pillars holding you up as a person, you've lost it. It's been knocked out.
I remember my mum sitting down on my bed, and for some reason she thought this would be useful, this explained that the amino acids that make up the proteins that make up your body, like, can only be repaired when you're asleep. And so I got this like spinning out vision of my cells like breaking apart because wasn't sleeping. And I was sleeping so much less than my son and so much less than my partner. I was like just in this sort of juddering awakeness all the time, feeling like I was falling apart.
Yeah, because I felt like I had to make more blood. I was like, I've got to make more blood. So I that totally would have set me off as well. They first gave me a sort of really mild sleeping tablet, and then they prescribed me a drug called quetiapine, which is actually to treat schizophrenic disorder if given in the proper dose. But it's safe to take with breastfeeding, so they gave me that. It worked the first night, and I kind of woke up the next day ready to go, and I was like, oh my God, I felt like I'm fixed. I started going to my GPs every day. Now, if I call up, oh my God, I don't even have to say anything. They just go, yes, you can have an appointment whenever you want, because they're like, here she comes. But one doctor kind of suggested that I had something called severe adjustment disorder. Now, this doctor was really great because she did go away and she spoke to other people and she wanted a second opinion. And I could tell she knew that it was more than baby blues. But very quickly, because the understaffed, you know, the stretch of the NHS, I didn't have that same person ever again. The notes were never, you know, I just didn't feel like there was one person across it going, how's this, how's that? Plus, the illness makes you lose trust in absolutely everybody. So every doctor that's saying it's this, they might pacify you for a minute and then you go away. And Hugo just said I would walk back. And within that short walk, I would go, I don't trust them. I thought there was something, no, they work for the government. I know they do. They're going to just take Jet. So very quickly, I would go back there.
Your paranoia in the book is amazingly described. When we talk about like paranoia, I tend to think of like drug-addled, middle-aged American male like outliers who live in a shack in the middle of nowhere with a gun.
Oh, waiting for UFOs.
Yeah. But the paranoia of a woman who is like at the locus of anxiety, responsibility, physical sort of repair, all of that stuff. I'd never really seen that. I'd never really heard anyone describing that sort of sliding out of trusting everyone at every turn.
If you search my illness, it says this is a medical emergency. It's an emergency. And how weird that the emergency, the thing that we're running from, is me killing myself or killing somebody else. When I think about that, I'm like, this is not the emergency. Could be, oh, if the oil canister falls into the gas and the little fire burns and that's the problem. Like, no, the threat here, it's not a monster. It's not a this, it's me. So that is a really weird thing to get your head around, that I need to be hospitalized because what I'm running away from is myself. So to somebody who doesn't understand it might just go, how about you just don't? And here's a thing for your bed saying sweet dreams, love, home. I mean, yeah. Like,
see, I remember someone saying to me, oh, I didn't sleep much last night because I was just staring at her face while she slept.
No,
and I was like,
no.
I'm sorry, what? What are you doing? Why would you?
Were you staring at it thinking how much she wants to punch it?
Yeah. Or were you staring at it thinking, what is that? I don't recognise that. What's going on?
Maybe, though. Maybe. Because it's the hardest time anyway to say you feel like you hate living so much you want to get out of it, or you think that everybody else hates you so much that you can't go on with causing this much pain to everybody. But you can't. It's hard enough anyway to say that when it's meant to be the best time of your life. It's like, no, this right now, talking to you now is a much better day for me.
I have friends who have got, like, a job interview. She got a job that she was completely unqualified for just because she was so happy and relieved to be away from her baby and in a job interview that she absolutely sailed through it. She was like really relaxed, really chatty, really excited, like signing up for all this stuff. She was like, time in the office away from my baby. Hell yeah. Like, you know.
Oh my God.
This is nicer. This is much nicer.
This is nicer because you feel like yourself.
You've talked about the emergency. And the emergency is, you know, the threat of yourself. And there's that lovely bit in the book where the doctor says to Hugo, if it were my daughter, I wouldn't wait. And so you were taken into hospital. At that point, where were you in your head? And what did that feel like to sort of be taken into a hospital?
The moment when I really knew that something bad was happening, I was changing. I wasn't sleeping at this point. I wasn't eating. My thoughts were really racing, or I was sort of slipping in moments throughout the day in sort of catatonia. So I would just be like I would find myself sort of daydreaming, but to the point of, do you ever catch yourself where you maybe think you're like really just standing there eating a piece of toast and you're like, I'm really doing this really uglily, but I just can't be bothered to change how uglily I'm doing this. Do you ever get that?
I sometimes think that my face looks like a melting candle.
Like, it doesn't. Just...
No, but like in those moments where it's like all muscle tone has just come out of my face.
Okay, yes. So there's a picture of me of this time where I'm eating actually in the picture. I just look washed out. I just look like I'm somewhere else. There was a day when I was changing Jet Snappy in here in this room and I would like to say it was normal because nothing was normal, but I was changing his nappy and I just heard inside my brain, I don't know if it was anxiety or a voice, just go some swear words beginning with F, you know, idiot, you terrible mum, like, what the hell are you doing? What do you think you're doing? And then I just remember pausing and stopping changing and said to Hugo, can you take over? I didn't tell him what I was hearing, experiencing. I sort of backed away from the room and we've got quite a long hallway to the bedroom. I don't know why I almost tried to run away from the voice, but ha-ha, jokes on me, guys, gotcha, because it's in my head, so it came with me. Went down the hallway, went into the bedroom, looked in the mirror. No, actually, my thought going down the hallway, weirdly, was, oh, no, it's back. But I don't know if it was a thought or a voice said, oh, it's back, which is really weird. I always think about that because I'm like, when I was younger in my teens, I used to dare myself. I don't know if you ever do that. If I don't drink this glass of water in the next 10 seconds, I'm going to die. I had that. That was around the time my parents were breaking up. I was a teenager and it just sort of went. I just sort of grew out of it, which I now know is kind of intrusive thoughts, OCD tendencies, kind of all blurring. Then went to the bathroom, looked in the mirror and it was like a kind of cooey, like a... here I am. And my eyes, they just weren't my eyes. They were just like someone else's eyes. I didn't go down that thread. That would have been an interesting thread. Someone else's eyes. It wasn't that. It was just like a shimmer, like someone else is here now. And God, this is it. You've actually gone mad. And that was when I thought, okay, it's turned up a notch. So Hugo had always been really great at having a psychotherapist his whole life because his mum passed away when he was in his teens. And so he just has somebody that he goes to if he ever needs to, just to talk. And it's so healthy. And I just always thought, oh, that's because his mum died. That's why. And he took me with him to go and see her. He had a session booked with her. And I was just rampant. I was just rocking the baby. My eyes were just... massive. I remember thinking, I was just manic walking around this room. I remember thinking for a minute, I could maybe sleep here. I feel like I could maybe sleep. If she just lets me sleep, I might be able to sleep because it felt quite cozy in there. And on the way back from there, in the, I don't know what they're called because I can't drive, but the mirror bit where the driver can see the top mirror in that little bit there, Hugo's eyes caught hold of my eyes because I was in the back with Jet. And I thought the voice or my thought went, he's seen the monster. He just saw you there. Don't look at him in the eyes again because he's just seen what you saw. This was where the thread began. And then I'd try and turn the radio on and concentrate on the words. I couldn't. I couldn't concentrate on a second of TV, on what anyone was saying. Time became completely abstract. And then I had all these narratives. So this, oh, it leads to da-da-da-da-da-da-da, suicide. Okay. So now what about this option? If you did a little, just go down there, do that, do that. Okay. Oh, suicide. Okay. And the problem with when you're someone like me who can't even do the monkey bars properly, like the idea of killing yourself is really difficult. And you think, I sort of need to hold a board meeting to discuss how to do this because I don't know. And I'm really scared of getting it half right. So the whole thing was extremely frightening. And that is what I'm so proud of myself for, because I just was going, I'm having these thoughts. They're really frightening me. And also, I'm back healthy again. I don't want to die. I love life so much. I've always loved life so much. And that's when I think this is not, to think that this illness is invisible when it's got you in this psychological chokehold. Inside, my brain was having a heart attack. My arms and legs were being chopped off, bleeding. This was not my fault. When people go, it's your fault, or you thought yourself into this position, or you did this. Sorry, absolutely not. You know, why would anybody ask to feel that way? The night that I was hospitalised, the night you're just speaking of, when the doctor said if my wife or daughter was going through this, I'd take them to hospital. I was on a really dark, heavy thread here at this point, which was that everybody knew all along that I was this sinister, dark person, and I was the last person to find out that I had manipulated. At the points I thought that Hugo, because we knew each other since we were kids, I sort of thought that he was still that 14-year-old boy, and I had manipulated him, coerced him into having a baby with me. And at points, I had dark thoughts, you know, leaning towards his mum, that I had somehow, like, I was trying to embody her. And these were just too heavy and too upsetting that, again, it would go, we obviously need to kill yourself because it's not normal to have thoughts like that. I mean, Hugo didn't even want his dad to know ever that he was vaping, and he was just freely vaping in front of his dad. And I was like, okay, this has got bad now, because he's just vaping in front of his dad now. So this is really bad. And the NHS couldn't get me an appointment till the Monday. This was on the Saturday night. And it was to see have talking therapy. I couldn't have waited. No way. Like, I felt so unsafe. Nobody could see the danger that I could see. When you liken it to thinking, if you were trapped in a burning building and you're on the top floor, you know, you might jump out, you know, because you're scared of the threat that is next to you, which is the burning flames. Or you might think you can somehow get yourself away of that, or be in control of your own fate. So yeah, then my sister came. Hugo rang around my whole family and called them all and said, I think it's time to take her to hospital. And then I was like driven in the middle of the night. I mean, that was wild. I was coming out with all these delusions. I didn't know where I was going. It's my own fault in that way. At this point, I was naive. I've only seen too many horror films, so I didn't know what a psychiatric ward was going to look like. I didn't know if it was going to be One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or if it was going to be a police station. Or also, at this point, my brain was so, like, if you had told me, I was very vulnerable. So if you had told me at this point I'd murdered somebody, I would have believed you, you know. If you'd said, Laura, you're now a hairband, I'd go, oh God, I'm a hairband. Better get used to that. This is how sponge-like my brain was. So actually, that's why the book's called What Have I Done as well, because I was thinking, I'm obviously being incarcerated for something and I don't know what it is. And the fact that it was the psychiatric ward was just not how I imagined it almost weirded me out even more again, because I was like, oh, it's just a really quite nice little room where you're just gonna get better. And then the doctor came to speak to me, and I remember my sister going, Laura, she looks like J-Lo, and me being like, yeah, okay, J-Lo's gonna get me better.
Wow. When I read that title, What Have I Done, I sort of thought, there is a massive taboo where if you've had a baby, to voice any doubt or regret over that is so taboo. Like, to say, I'm not sure if I should have done this. I'm not sure I was ready for this. I'm not sure I can do this. I'm not sure I love them. I'm not sure that they are a nice baby or person or whatever. Massively taboo. And so because we're not allowed to say it, it haunts us and goes on and on. And equally, people who choose not to have children, it's really taboo for them to say, I don't know if I've made the right decision. I really regret that. I really wish I'd become a mum. I'm really sad that I'm not going to do that. And every time I get my period, I cry because I worry that I've made it. And it sort of drives that, you know, in my book and in my life, that's the thing that drives me along, is that sort of feeling that Why? Why is it taboo to say that? Like, why were you and I both so worried about admitting to anyone that we had ambivalence or doubt or regret about what we'd done? Because it's such a huge, seismic, life-changing thing to have done. You're almost mad if you haven't. You haven't doubted it.
And I've had many conversations in the park or a playgroup or something with somebody when I've gone, it's hard though, isn't it? And they go, yeah, it's not that hard. And I go, like, you know that scene in Bridesmaids? And I go, but it is quite hard. And they go, yeah, it's really not that hard. It's so rewarding. And I'm going, yeah, but is it though? And they're like, yeah. And I just think, wow. But nearly, you know, the messages that I will get from people that have read the book, that the ones that I mostly get are from people saying, oh, I didn't realise that's what it was, or that it was okay to feel like that. Or looking back, I definitely had postnatal depression, but it wasn't diagnosed and I just carried on. Why do we just think we need to carry on and coping, especially when we've got a new person that we have to completely look after, that is our total responsibility, and not just look after, love and genuinely care for? That's an enormous pressure. I think there's like, it's actually corrosive to say that it's not possible at any point to say, I need help. How are you feeling?
Do you think if you could go back and tell the Laura of, let's say, 25 or 28, that this was going to happen, do you think it would have changed the way you approached your, that sort of time, your relationship, your decision to have a baby?
It's really funny, that question, because so Hugo, I was like my partner, I crushed on him since I was 13 years old. So if someone had said to me, you're going to have a baby with somebody that you have been in love with your whole life, because I only got with him when I was 30, so 4 years ago, I never, that in itself would have been like, oh my God. If somebody had said, then you're going to go on this journey, you're going to have this crusade and you're going to have to go through this massive challenge, and but at the other side of it is going to be everything you've ever wanted since you were a little girl, I would have gone, yeah, I'll do it 10 times. Like, I would. The idea though, before of some, I probably would have not have had a baby if I'd have known how that, this is not Jet being Jet now, but going through that, because that was extreme jeopardy. and that was, I lost it all, you know, having your mum have to physically lie on top of you for a whole night because you're that suicidal, that that she's scared to even let you, you know, you want to break free from the bed. That is something I'll never want my mum to have to go through. I wouldn't want to do that with my son. That said, I'm better for my illness. Like, I really am. Right. And I needed that. It's made me plug into the world so much better. Like, if I get rejections from work or whatever, I just go, okay, if I lose files, if stuff happens, you know, I just go, wow. Like, CBT, learning CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, I almost feel like I needed that to learn CBT. Would I have ever have picked up those tools before? That has got me through this pandemic, that has just helped me with everything. And to learn skills like that in your 30s when you're a mom, I'm just like, thank you so much for that wisdom, which you could only really get that from sitting in a psychiatric ward, listening to people that maybe before, not judged, but you would have thought, oh, I'm not like those people, I don't have a mental illness. How lucky me, going, no, actually, you're not immune from anything like that, from any car crash of life. And that, I almost feel like this has been the thing, it broke me, but it also made me.
Welcome back. I've just noticed there's a little pile of sticks in front of me where someone's tried to start a fire rather haphazardly using their homework. And their sort of scrunched up paper homework and some sticks. I don't think it was particularly successful, but very sweet that they tried. As you probably picked up from that, I was a bit starstruck talking to Laura, and so talked loads. At one point, my producer even had to text me telling me to stop honking over her like a goose. They weren't the words he used, but that was very much the message. But you can probably tell a lot of this stuff is very close to my heart, which is why I wanted to speak to a mental health professional about what it's actually like to be on a psychiatric ward, away from the stereotypes and sensationalism of film and television. Dr. Benjamin Janaway is an NHS psychiatrist and mental health campaigner. How does someone end up on a psychiatric ward?
It's something that only really occurs when someone is very unwell. And unfortunately, the media and films have a very dramatic way of portraying this one. It's often very inaccurate. But it tends to occur with people one of two ways. One, they recognise the level of severity of their illness and think that they need that help. And that's agreed by the doctors and another professional who always kind of have to be involved. Or it's somebody who is so unwell that they present a risk to themselves and or others. And this can be through a variety of means. It can be through direct action to themselves or not eating, not drinking, or putting themselves at a significant risk. And then they can be taken in under a legal act that is quite difficult to actually describe in detail. But the whole kind of influence of the act is to identify those that are really at risk and try and provide a least restrictive way of treating them. But sometimes the necessity of the admission is so high that we can bring them in under a legal precedent.
And is that what a lay person would call getting sectioned?
Yes.
And what happens once you are on a psychiatric ward? I know it probably differs from hospital to hospital, but is there a kind of a common thread or a sort of series of stages that someone might go through?
So there are two major groups when it comes to hospital admission. There are those that are coming in for the first time or the reason for their admission is not completely clear. There's a number of symptoms or behaviours that they may be exhibiting, but we haven't quite come to a conclusion as to why that's happening. That could be a difference between a first episode of psychotic illness, an organic psychotic illness, or it could be that they're using some kind of street drug which mimics the symptoms. So we need a bit of time to work out what's going on. The second group are people where there is a known diagnosis and for some reason they've relapsed in their mental state. This could be because they've forgotten to take a certain medication, that they've developed an infection, which means they're not absorbing the medication properly. Or it could just be that there's some other trigger event in their lives, which means they've had to come back in. The first group usually comes in under a section 2. This is a 28-day section, which allows us time to assess and begin treatment on what's going on. And the second group can go for a little bit longer. Sometimes that first section is converted into the second, but there's always a legal process which allows the patient to contest either of these sections at any one time. And from my own personal experience as a doctor, we try to avoid the use of sections wherever possible and rescind them and have the patient stay in as someone who wants to be there, or at least it was agreeable to be there, perhaps not wants to be there, but is agreeable to be there of their own volition. And this is kind of the ideal. The section is really the last ditch. It's very necessary to bring this person in. But as a result, and because of the media and things, there's a large amount of stigma about it. And as I get more and more senior, my level of comfort with the use of sections has diminished quite a lot over time. It really has to be that this is a life-saving intervention.
You've talked about how the way that you're treating someone will change over that period of time, as you come to understand their conditions and their circumstances and their own sort of individual pathology, I suppose. How do you know someone's getting better once they're in a psychiatric ward?
So the best person to tell you that a patient is getting better is the patient. Now, I can split this down a little bit further into two major states. There can be a patient that has insight to what's going on. I know I am depressed. I know these voices are not real. And I know that I do not have to kill myself. And there are patients without insight. I believe that I am to blame for some great atrocity, that I must kill myself. And the gaining of insight is one key indicator that someone is getting better. There are all sorts of scales that we can use, different things cooked up over the years by different psychologists and psychiatrists that measure different tenets of a person, be it their enthusiasm, the way they're moving around, the pressure and rate of their speech. And if you were to measure those at points of time, you can see objective improvements. For me, the most obvious one, apart from the patient saying, hey, I feel a bit better, is what I call, or what we all call, a change in their mental state. And what that is the mental state examination is when you look at somebody and talk with somebody and do a basic screening for the evidence of psychopathology, i.e. delusions, hallucinations, obsessive thoughts, intrusive thoughts, and it creates a snapshot of that person. And what you can see is that changes over time. But it's very much a team view as well. So the nurses will tell us that there's a change, the patients will tell us that there's a change, and we'll generally see a change. But under all of it is a certain change in the air of somebody. Something that is a very type one thinking response. There is a gut feeling in yourself that reacts to their projection of emotion or the transference of their experience. And you can feel that something better. It's very hard to articulate. Yeah. But there is a change in the air about them.
It makes so much sense, and yet I've never thought about it, that if you're even watching the way someone walks, the way they sit, the way they handle their clothes, the direction they're looking when they talk to you, all of that is the measure that we use with people outside of a psychiatric ward. So why wouldn't you use it within one to sort of deem how someone's behaving? So let's imagine that we're at the stage where someone is starting to feel or present better, fond of a better word. What happens then? How do you deem that someone's ready to go home?
The aim is always to get someone home. If we were to take this from the most severe patient through to someone who is ready to go, there'll be usually a number of stages, not to look purely diagnostically. Is the person eating, drinking, taking medication? Are they suicidal? Are there psychotic symptoms present? What's the level of detriment this is having to their experience? Are they low? Are they engaging? All the different cornucopia of different things that we could consider have to be taken into account. But the first stage really is getting the person to engage with a treatment that's helpful and help them understand. Now, I've worked with patients that are extremely psychotic. And in that sense, it's not so much for me to try to get them to understand the rationale for the treatment. It's to help them see that I'm able to help. And often I'll just have conversations about the extent of their delusions, help them try to reason through them, knowing that actually I may not be able to fully ever understand, but it's to help them in a way that they can see is helpful. It's to find a level of communication. Now, the question isn't so much when is someone ready to go? It's more when do they want to go and can they be supported in that? So if somebody isn't 100% back together, which many, many people aren't when they leave, it's about knowing when they go, they have a level of support. So we have home treatment teams that kind of bridge the gap between the ward and the community mental health teams or general practitioner who will come in for patients and check in on them on the first time that they go home. This could be for a couple of days, it could be for a couple of weeks. They review what's going on, medications, and if things continue to improve, they may be able to discharge them back to their GP. So you have a buffer zone between the hospital and home where you're at home, but there is a certain level of extra help. There are other ways you can do this. You can go to a rehabilitation unit, which allows you to stay a bit longer. You can go to a crisis house if you just need a few weeks away from home. But the general setup is that this is not a on-off switch. It's not, all right, you've had your treatment, now bugger off. It's what can we plug you into to make things better? And this can be a community mental health team after that. And it might be that you only see a psychiatrist once every 6 months, but you have a care coordinator who assists you with day-to-day life. You have greater access to help if you need it. But these are all driven on the level of need. And unfortunately, as with any system that is publicly funded and massively overburdened, there have to be decisions made about priority.
I like it. I mean, I'd call it underfunded and overburdened, but that's your choice. I think there's a lot about psychiatric hospitals that is incredibly mundane and prosaic that people won't have thought about, that they're, you know, like the kind of bedding you'll be given and the kind of food you'll be given and the kind of activities that you'll be offered. That side of it I find incredibly interesting, but it also seems kind of, I think I find it interesting because it is so mundane. So if you are in a psychiatric ward, is there a chance that you're going to be eating like Marmite toast and going to a, like, to watch telly with people? Can it get that boring?
So it varies from place to place, but actually you may be pleasantly surprised. Now, I'm not going to pretend the food is, you know, five-star world renowned, and there is the odd baked potato, but there is a range of stuff, and I think the hospitals try very hard to make it good for your patients. But actually, the food, when I look at it sometimes, I think, oh, crikey, I want some of that. And that's not just because I've been living on coffee and nicotine for the last 12 hours. The other thing is the activities. Now, there is go watch TV. That's fine. But at the last ward I worked at, There was a fantastic activities coordinator who worked with the occupational therapists who were heavily involved with patients. And they did all types of activities, things that actually I would sometimes join. There was a karaoke thing they did every week. And honestly, I have heard some of the best and worst rapping I've ever heard from staff and patients, actually. They had video games and they had kind of letter writing. They had pottery, painting. I have a painting from one of my patients on my wall forever now that he made me, and it's always going to be there. But I think the biggest thing that these wards can encourage is a sense of community. And what I've seen is patients making little groups. I remember being on the ward at one point, it's 2 a.m, and there's a bunch of younger female patients there, and they're kind of walking around just causing a bit of mischief, but not in a way that I'm concerned about. They're just enjoying themselves and they're giving me a bit of a ribbing, and I'm saying to them, what kind of trouble are you guys causing? And we're actually just getting on. It's a very human thing. And I think that's what we need to bring to psychiatry. And what I see the most in psychiatry is that it provides a community of support. These places do not have to be the image that they are given in the media of some terrifying, blank, beige 1970s prison. Now, nothing's perfect. This is still the NHS. But the way I look at it is this. When you're treating a patient, medication is 5% of what you do. It may be the most essential thing that you can do at that very much, at that exact time. That specific drug might be so essential. But 95% of that experience, 95% of the recovery is about communicating to that person that they are a human being. And for me, that means that my job is not to sit there and prescribe medication. It is may need to learn and understand that patient. And if that requires a little bit of hedonism, buying chocolate cake, playing video games with them, just chatting absolute rubbish as humans do, then that's what we can. And there's no illusion that psych wards are perfect. I mean, but the more we can have the human element in there, the better these places are.
Hello, friends. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. I'm still here in my knicker-smelling bower. And there's now a magpie, which is probably on the lookout for bottle caps to throw at small children. Thank you to Laura and Benjamin for talking to me this week. And thank you to all of you who have already subscribed to the podcast. It's really great to see it doing so well. But most of all, thank you to my producer, Rich, who makes the whole thing tick. As this is the last episode of the season, we're going to take a little break for a couple of weeks, but we'll be back and fresher than ever very soon with lots more amazing guests, experts, and if you're lucky, more of me sitting in weird, muddy outdoor locations. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and actually even if you haven't, please subscribe and leave me a glowing 5-star review so more people can find it. It makes a huge difference. It feels great. And like licking your lips, will cost you absolutely nothing.
This is a brand new audio production.